you look nice and warm in your jacket.
Yes, thanks. How are you, Noxie?
I'm good, Chaman. I'm good. How are you?
Banjani lapha, Credog.
Yeah, they're fighting these guys. They started something that we don't know. And now the Credog 4 has been replaced by a Credog 50. Yes.
Yeah.
These young lions have got so much energy. I mean, really.
The city of Matthew Goniwe.
The city of Matthew Goniwe, yeah. They've got a lot of energy. But at the same time, you know, sometimes the way we do things also, you find that they somehow keep us in check, but they keep us in check in a way that is really not suitable. You know, you find that, okay, they might be raising issues that are tangible, but the way they do things, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, but well, we could. We're surviving under the circumstances.
No, that's great. Alan, Sister Tebu, how many members are connected?
Morning, Chair. Alan, yeah. Obviously, there's Honorable Pelezi, Skostana, Morolong, Abraham, Mabilesa and Jordan Hill all online. Only apology I've received is from voter vessels.
Okay. I think there's a substantial number to say that we can start with the meeting. Shenge, now you are Swembu in terms of online connection. Hey, we have been missing you for a long time. Nkosi Buthelezi. Let me welcome members of the Standing Committee of Finance, officials from Treasury and SARS, officials from Parliament, our stakeholders who made oral and written submissions. You are all welcome. And the meeting is officially open. The only apology we have is from Honorable Vessels. Today's meeting is about the response by National Treasury and SARS to the submissions received on TLAB, TALAB, and 2020 rates and monetary amounts and amendment of revenue laws bill, known as the rates bill. So that's the purpose of today's meeting. Let's move right away to item two, the National Treasure. Is Madam Yanga and Momo, are they here?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. Chair, no, thank you very much. And just to mention all the names of all the bills we're dealing with, and you've rightly pointed out, we're dealing with three bills today, the rates bill, the TLAB bill, and the TALAB bills.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you, but the T-shirt in a formal meeting like this.
I apologize. I'll get my formal wear on in a moment, Chair.
it's unlike you. Okay, proceed.
Yeah. No, Chair. What's Chair? I think just to apologize also to members. I mean, I think the team has had to really do a superhuman effort to get these documents out. If many have been working the entire night. And I think just to point out that, you know, we normally have at least two plus weeks to prepare a response document after the last hearing. We've done it now within a week. So apologies for that. But, and just to remind honorable members that all the docs we have today are draft documents. So you have the draft response doc and we have some slides. And the draft response doc is quite a lengthy document. I think it's about 84 pages. And what we try and do every year is to look at on all the points mentioned, all the submissions. We try and get the gist of each submission, and we put down all the points, and we provide at least a one or two paragraph response on each and every point that we believe we need to respond to. And it's a draft because we haven't tested it with our bosses, with the DG or with the minister. And what we do is, as Chair, just remind ourselves, these are also draft bills, so you'll get sick of us using the word draft. And the reason is that, unlike the COVID bills, which were tabled, that we prefer when it comes to the text bills that we put on a draft, we just put out a draft bill, it's not table, and that allows the committee then to make changes and so on. And after this, what we'll do is we amend the bill that we published, and that bill is revised, taken to the state law advisors, and then it's tabled. And of course, on the table bill, the money bills procedure rules take effect. So we reduce the possibility of making too many amendments. We try and really reduce it to very few amendments if it's necessary, which has happened after the bill is tabled. So, Chair, what we're going to do today is therefore, just as I said, go through all the proposals. The PowerPoint presentation picks up on some of the bigger issues. It doesn't go through the document. It doesn't go through each and every proposal that's been made. So I think just bear that in mind. And if you want to know on all, any matter what the response is that's in the document. Chair, the other point I should just add up front is unlike what we always try and do is only deal with issues that have been raised in the budget, in the February budget, in these bills. And we don't raise any other issue. But this year, because of COVID, as you know, we've had to have a special, the COVID bills that were passed by this committee. And secondly, we've also had to take into account further proposals on COVID. And in particular, we do deal today with the 183 rule. We do have reservations about some of the proposals on getting a loan against pension funds. I know that there's a private members bill coming, but the department has great concerns about that in principle, just given the low savings culture. But we'll deal with all of these. So, Chair, we also then deal with the tobacco excise issues because right up to yesterday, I should say, that we are still getting submissions coming to us that have been submitted to the committee. So, yes, they may be late, but, you know, we try and see what we can take into account. So, hence, seeing the delay and the fact that people have worked all night. You may find typos in this bill. Those will be cleaned up because what we do, when we have the table bill, we finalized this draft document, the draft response document. And sometimes, I think like last year, there's a need to amend one or two things because new info comes up. We then alert the committee when we come and talk on the table bill that these are the changes that have been made. So, Chair, we've got a huge team, both from the Treasury and led by Yanga and Chris. These are the two chief directors within the Treasury, and our colleagues from SARS, which is led by Franz Tomasek. I think just to move on with the slides, I know, Chris, I don't see the slides up. Okay. So the slides sort of deal with the consultation. I won't go through it, but just says when we first published the bills, when we had the closing dates, when we had the hearings, all the other meetings that take place on these proposals, etc. You can move on with the slide. And I've just dealt with some of the exceptional measures because of COVID that we've had to deal with. Who's starting, Yanga or Chris? I think it's Chris with...
Yes, I think I'll get to ask Mpo to...
Okay, so these are the key issues. So Mpo is coming in. Okay, so go ahead.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I'll be dealing with tobacco excise increases as it relates to the rate bill. In the rate bill, we increased the tobacco excise specifically for in relation to this comment on cigarettes from 16.66 per pack of 20 to 17.40 per pack of 20. And the comment that we have received was that the increases that were effected in the budget this year exceeded the 40% excise incidence that we normally use as a guiding principles around the excise tax on tobacco products. And the request is that because we have exceeded the 40% excise incidence, we should not be increasing excise in the following budget to get back to the 40% excise incident guidelines that we use. We know the comments that have been made to say that yes, the incidence this year is slightly more than the 40% policy guidelines that we use. But the policy guideline also outlines that the increases that we make on excise taxes on an annual basis takes the larger of an inflationary increase or the targeted incidence. And what sometimes happens is that the industry, when we increase excise by more than inflation, the industry sometimes absorbs a portion of the excise increases. So when we make an adjustment next year in line with inflation or slightly above inflation, the 40% incidence target is exceeded because the prices of tobacco products, especially maybe cigarettes, was not increased to the same extent as the increases in excise. But we note all that comment that was made around that. Next slide. And also it was recommended that because of the problems with illicit trade and also the the sales ban that was effected with regards to the lockdown and dealing with the COVID pandemic, that we should not be increasing excises because we are going to lose revenue and also basically fuel illicit trade in tobacco products. And our position is that we don't accept that we should not, as government, implement our excise tax regime because there is illicit trade in tobacco products. You know, the fear of loss of revenue for the fiscus is not a sufficient motivation for government to then abandon its excise policy on tobacco products. The issue of illicit trade must be addressed through law enforcement mechanism. And SARS has done quite a number of interventions with regards to increasing capacity and dealing, and again collaborating with other law enforcement agencies to deal with this issue. So we don't think that we should then stop implementing our excise tax policy regime because of those problems. Those problems must be addressed concurrently. And another issue that was raised was that the implementation of excise regime has failed over time to decrease smoking in the country. And basically it has failed. What it has done is just to increase or fuel illicit trade. And we don't accept that, because since the implementation of the broad government strategy around reducing consumption of tobacco products since 1993, research has shown that taxes and non-tax measures that are implemented by the Department of Health to deal with tobacco consumption has reduced smoking prevalence in South Africa. So we don't think that we should abandon the normal increases in excise because there is that issue of illicit trade, and we don't agree that it hasn't achieved its intended objectives. Again, in the budget this year, we introduced a new category for heated tobacco products. And what we announced in the budget was that the taxation of heated tobacco products will be equated to 75% of the excise that is applicable to cigarettes. We received comments to say that the way that it has been done in terms of the rate bill, we should be doing it per stick instead of applying a weight-based system, because cigarette is currently taxed on a per pack basis instead of the weight basis. We note that comment to say that the current category that we have in the rate bill is quite a broad category, which captures all the heated tobacco products. And there is a nuances that needs to be made. And we have already started plans together with SARS to look at refining that category, because currently it's quite broad. And we want to refine it to be specific to the regards to the different products that are involved in terms of heated tobacco products. And the intention is that heated tobacco products, especially heat, should be taxed similarly to cigarettes, albeit at the concessionary rate of 75%. And on top of that, just to say that the current weight base get us to an effective rate that is close to what we intended in terms of having a 75% excise rate on heated tobacco products compared to cigarette excise. Thank you, Chair. Chris, will you deal with that?
Export taxes. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. The Taxation Laws Amendment Bill included an amendment that was announced from the previous budget on an introduction of export tax on scrap metals. This follows from the price preferential system, which was developed and implemented through ITAC in 2013. The PPS was, the objective of the PPS was to improve the availability of better quality scrap at lower prices, to enable the domestic market to be more cost competitive. It was found that, you know, through the years of the PPS, it has not been as effective as it was hoped, and there were problems with how the administration was done, and it was quite easy for the suppliers of scrap metal to be able to circumvent the system. As a result, ITAC put forward an investigation, and the DTIC have proposed an export tax on scrap metal, as it would be a superior process to the PPS. It would be easier to administer, and it would hopefully get rid of some of the negative consequences of introducing the PPS previously. So the comments we've received on this, the first one was, you know, what we've said, the price preference system has proved to be ineffective. There was a lot of strong support for this to replace the PPS to assist local manufacturers and local foundries. The overall response is that this has been accepted, that we would continue to include the export tax within the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. We recognize that scrap metal is a key input. We recognize that the PPS was not working as effectively as it could have. And we also recognize that an export duty would be perhaps easier to administer and might have better outcomes. So it is going to be included. We would like to note that there are still some difficulties with this, even though we are moving ahead. South Africa is a signatory to a number of key trade agreements, so it limits the use of export taxes in the number and the timing. And for those who we don't have trade agreements, there could be a threat of retaliation for their own export taxes for markets that we are involved in. For example, the EPA only allows up to 8 export taxes, so you'll see in the legislation we've included 8, but there are actually 9 line items there. I think we're actually changing it for a reason I'll go into later. But any items above the 8 will not attract an export duty on these products. You know, export taxes are a blunt tool, so we are using it to try and achieve an objective, but it's blunt, and it might not be exactly in line with what we are looking for, so we will need to continue looking at this and reviewing it. And all export taxes, we believe, need to really be carefully considered. What you are trying to do is you're directly harming one industry for the direct benefit of another, which then hopefully creates wider benefits for the broader economy. But by directly harming the one industry already, you are imposing a cost and imposing a drag on growth. So it needs to be carefully viewed in terms of whether the wider benefits do realize. The other comment was, in light of the shortage and insecurity of supply, government should ban the export of scrap. Now, this isn't exactly a tax proposal, but it does relate to the tax proposal that we are putting in. In our view, the current ban that was put in place in the last few months on scrap metal, it would be difficult to have this on a permanent basis, and the export tax is there to try and alleviate pressure on the industry, which could then allow for a removal of the ban. There are different, we try to say how there are different impacts on the severity of either having a ban or a quota or an export tax. You know, we think an export tax would be the most efficient way of doing this because it still could allow trade to take place, even though it is done at a differential price. So by introducing the export tax, we can create this wedge between domestic and world prices, so that hopefully it can benefit our local consumers of the scrap metal. Whereas even if the world prices go up, the local price might go up, but it'll be at a lower nominal level. So we do say that if you are thinking of a quota or a ban, an export tax would probably be preferable, even though it does come with some limitations. We did have other comments that said any duty or restriction on the movement of metallic scrap for recycling would be detrimental in the long term, especially to the general economy. Basically, this is saying that the wider benefits to the economy weren't realized. At the moment, we're saying not accepted, so this, we're not taking the proposal out of the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. We are going to include these measures to try and support the local availability of good quality scrap. There was another comment that a decrease in the local scrap price would dampen the incentive for collection, would negatively impact the informal sector in particular, and not be beneficial. Although there might be a small impact, we do believe that it will be overall beneficial, as since we have actually included the amendment. We do note those points. There was another comment that stainless steel scrap should have its own category of export taxation. Its inclusion in the ferrous metals category, which we had initially in the initial bill, would render the taxation to be at a very low value. We've agreed with that. Stainless steel is a very different grade of scrap at a higher value. So we're going to include another additional line item. This is what I was mentioning before about the 9 items versus 10. And there will be an applicable rate for that, which will be different to ferrous metals. Another comment was that there's no justification for this at all. For those that are processed or currently required in SA or SACU, or that are in small, exported in such small quantities that the imposition of an export duty will serve no purpose. So this is quite a tricky one. You have tariff codes that we impose the tax on, but there might be an element of scrap metal that is lumped in within that tariff code that is a very small amount or it isn't used locally. At the moment, we've noted that point. This is part of the reason that an export tax is a very blunt instrument. It would be very difficult administratively and also from a legislative point of view to dig down to every different type of grade of scrap metal and how it's used for and the values in between of those amounts to then cater for all these issues. So we do, at the EPA agreement, we only have up to 8. It's a very difficult thing to do to try and go down to every level of scrap. So at the moment it's noted, but we haven't made any adjustments there. Another one point that was made is that the rand value per ton, because in our previous draft TLAB, we put forward a fixed value per ton. So 1,000 rand per ton of ferrous scrap is what the export duty would be. The comments we received is that the rand value actually constantly varies, especially on the global markets. It goes up, it goes down, it's all over the place. So it's not dynamic enough, this fixed rate, to be effectively disruptive. If the price increases dramatically, then the 1,000 rand per ton might have a much lower percentage rate and it might increase exports to the detriment of the local industry. If the price decreases dramatically, the export tax might be a very large percentage of the price, and then any exporters would not benefit from being able to export at all. So we do recognize that. But also, a fixed duty will serve to further install the distortions that are evident from the PPS. Another problem is that within each tariff item that I've spoken about, the values of those scrap is not the same. But at the moment, we've put a single fixed rate, say 1,000 rand per ton, regardless of the value of the scrap. You might have higher quality scrap that has a higher value, lower quality scrap that has a lower value, but if it's still charged 1,000 rand per ton, it'll have all these different impacts. So we had comments to say, can this not be changed to an ad valorem tax? And we've accepted that proposal. We agree with that. We think the economic benefits of moving to an ad valorem rate are quite substantial. This will then allow for the different grades of scrap to still be exported. It won't result in cases where suddenly a fixed rate of ton means recycling that scrap is completely uneconomical, which might leave scrap not being actually supplied and being left in buildings or left in yards in the country. So by moving to an ad valorem rate, you can both deal with the changing price in the world market that moves all the time and it can stay at the same percentage. And you can deal with these different grades of scrap within each tariff item. And you can deal with, you do not make it uneconomical to be able to supply some levels of scrap. So we think there's a very good justification for that. There are, however, concerns about this. The concerns are that, suppliers of scrap will under-invoice or under-declare in terms of their declarations for exports. And the duty, the amount that you export, still needs a certificate from ITAC in order to make those exports. That will be checked with SARS. SARS have also, they do already administer a lot of the trade-related taxes on an ad valorem basis where they use invoices, and they have procedures in order to check and try and find out and source out cases where under invoices has applied and has taken action on those items. So we believe SARS will have the administrative ability to do this, but we recognize that given those risks, we must keep reviewing to see whether this ad valorem rate is not leading to large amounts of under invoicing, but the potential benefits from our perspective of using it are why we've accepted that comment. There are a couple of other comments. You know, South Africa could consider a refund mechanism rather than an exemption, because there's a worry that some exporters will pretend that they're going to export to a duty-free country and then take the export elsewhere. So it's saying that everybody must pay the export tax, but if you've proven that it's gotten to a country where it is duty-free at the end, then you can get a refund of that amount initially. You know, we can't administer that. We don't think that we are going to be able to deal with that. So at the moment, we are not including a refund mechanism. We're also not including quota mechanisms for the same reason. We'd have to carefully consider them going forward. It's also a request that a PPA stays in place for exporter countries. This is actually more a DTIC and ITAC issue. So we had said not accepted, but it's actually up to them. Our understanding was that it wouldn't apply to those countries, but they would have to, I'm sure, make a comment on that. Yanga, would you like to go on?
No, let me just come in, Chris. No, thanks, Chris. Chair, I think, Chris has outlined this is one of the more difficult proposals that we have to look at on the export tax. And I think there are a lot of challenges that we see. For example, and we heard some of it in the hearings, whether they related to VAT fraud, whether it's related to money laundering, whether it's related to dumping, or the fact that a lot of scrap steel, it's not economical for it to be removed from buildings and so on. And what we've been guided, obviously, by the Department of Trade and Industry and Competitiveness to use this tool. I think, like Chris has outlined, we're very mindful that there's a limit in terms of trade agreements to 8, but even just in terms of normal economic theory, that there are limitations as well. And for that reason, the minister also has a discretionary power, which if there are any major unintended consequences that the minister could use. I think that the key issue is that what we're effectively doing also is choosing industries to support or not support in this measure. There will be different ones within the steel sector which are impacted differently. So we really do need to monitor. And what we're going to do with the Department of Trade and Industry and with ITAC, just to monitor as this tax gets implemented, that, you know, the market functions in the way that's desired. But I'll stop there. Thank you, Chair. Yanga, are you?
Yes. We are coming to the addressing an anomaly in the tax exemption of employer-provided bursaries. Last week, this was the most topical issue that was presented in Parliament. We had presenters from different associations doing oral presentations on this issue. Currently, the Income Tax Act contains rules that provide exemption in respect of bursaries provided to relatives of employees and to employees by those employers of those employees. In 1992, when these provisions were introduced, the exemption was dependent on the fact that the employee's remuneration package was not subject to an element of salary sacrifice. Last week, the issue of salary sacrifice was discussed simply. A salary sacrifice is an exchange of part of your salary before tax, so you can get benefits, for example, a bursary. So meaning that you pay for your bursary, you pay for your children's education before tax. Let's say if your total income per month is 150, and then 20 rands goes to is salary sacrifice so that you can pay for the school fees and is regarded as a bursary, meaning that you pay tax on 130 rands. Whereas someone who does not have the benefit of a salary sacrifice, of which that is provided by different employers, mostly the corporate. So if you do not have the benefit of a salary sacrifice, you'll pay your tax on 150 and pay your school fees for the children's school fees after tax. So meaning that someone who has got a benefit of a salary sacrifice pays school fees before tax. Those were the rules where that in 1992, the exemption was not provided if the salary of the employee was subject to an element of a salary sacrifice. In 2006, the changes were made to the law to remove the element of a salary sacrifice rule, meaning that from 2006, the exemption on employer-provided bursary was available even if there was an element of salary sacrifice. Over the years, we have increased the cap on the employee's salary that qualify for the bursaries up to 600,000, I think in 2018. If I'm correct, but the cap is currently 600,000. We have seen so many schemes being advertised by different institutions from even the employers, whereby they are marketing this provision of salary sacrifice and employer-provided bursaries. Next page, Chris. As a result, in order to close the loophole, the following changes were proposed in the 2020 draft TLAB that was published for public comment. It was proposed that the exemption will only apply if the employer is providing bursaries not only to the relatives but also open to the general public. The second requirement was that the exemption will apply, but if there's an element of salary sacrifice, the exemption is not going to apply. Thirdly, we said that if there's an element of salary sacrifice, there's not going to be an employer deduction. Next slide, Chris. We received a lot of comments. We received a lot of comments from the taxpayers in this regard, even from the one you can call your independent or Model C schools. And there were other commentators that came to Parliament last week. The first comment was that the requirement that bursaries to relatives of employees also be bursaries available to general public is restrictive. We accepted that. And here we are proposing that changes should be made in the revised draft TLAB to be tabled so as to remove the requirement that it should be open to general public. As a result, the tax exempt status will not be dependent on whether or not the bursary is open to members of the general public. The second one was that in the budget announcement, we said that this applies only to relatives of an employee, but in the bill, we said both employees and relatives. That was an error on our part. That was, we're gonna remove the the reference to employees because it only applies to relatives. Next slide. Okay, this was the one that was presented mostly in Parliament last week, whereby they said we should reinstate the salary sacrifice requirement. And then reinstating the salary sacrifice requirement undermines government objectives for skills development. We understand that in 2006, when we took away this salary sacrifice requirement, we talked about skills development. However, we are of the view that, yes, at a particular point in time, policy changes because of what is happening, based on the schemes that we have seen. And secondly, as I've explained earlier, when there is a salary sacrifice, it is still disputable even now if that can be regarded as a bona fide bursary, because the employer is not providing bursary per se. The employer is taking money from your salary and devising a scheme, a cost-to-company scheme, to say this is a salary sacrifice. That is not a bona fide bursary. So that is the view that even now, when you look at the interpretation, SARS can say this is not a bona fide bursary, but because in 2006 it was stated that the element of salary sacrifice is removed. But we are of the view that the minute you have a salary sacrifice, it's not a bursary. You are paying for your fees before tax, whereas someone who does not have a salary sacrifice is paying for the fees after tax, and that does not result into an equitable result. Next slide. The next one is that we made proposals in the TLAB to say that if there's an element of salary sacrifice, there won't be an employer deduction. So based on the comments received, we're going to remove that requirement. So if there's an element of salary sacrifice, there will be an employer deduction, but you won't get qualified for the bursary exemption. The last comment that we received was that due to current COVID-19 crisis, effecting the proposed change will impede companies' ability to assist middle and lower income earners provide education for relatives. If the proposal is not amendment, they request postponement for 2 or 3 tax years so that it can be considered after that time. Our view is that this is not a COVID-19 related tax measure. In the 2020 budget, the effective date was that we put on the budget, it was 1 March 2020. It was retrospective. Hence, the date was announced in the budget announcement. So now, based on the comments received, the effective date is no longer retrospective. The effective date is prospective. It will apply from 1 March 2021. Therefore, what is left of this proposal is that we have removed the test that it should be open to general public. We have removed the requirement that it's also applying to employees. It will only apply to relatives. The salary sacrifice requirement is the only requirement that remains. Lastly, if there is a salary sacrifice, employers will be allowed to deduct. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Yanga. The next issue was withdrawing from retirement funds upon immigration. This arose from the changes that were announced in Annexure E of the budget review, government looking to modernize the exchange control system and move to a new capital flow management system. The big change was that in relation to individuals in the modernization, the concept of immigration for exchange control purposes is going to be phased out. This is quite a big implication for some parts of the Tax Act, as the Tax Act relies on that concept of immigration to happen for particular actions to occur. And in this case, the lump sum benefit that a member can take when they immigrate from South Africa from a retirement annuity fund or a pension preservation or a provident preservation fund, it allows those individuals to take that amount from those funds if they were to immigrate, and that immigration is recognized by the Reserve Bank for exchange control purposes. Now that the concept of immigration is going to be removed, there would have been no way for those who leave the country to be able to access their retirement funds, or their retirement annuity fund, or their pension preservation or provident preservation fund. So to try and put in a new measure that will replace the old one, the draft TLAB proposed that if members remained non-tax resident for 3 consecutive years or longer, they would then qualify. So the new trigger after removing the immigration definition is that you are a non-tax resident and you have been a non-tax resident for 3 consecutive years or longer. The comments on this, we've had quite a few comments that have opposed this amendment. They state that the 3-year waiting period places a financial burden on the individual. That individual then can't use those amounts to cover the settling in costs and to move to the new country. It also creates additional requirements for fund members, SARs, and fund administrators. The SARs will also face a cash flow delay as they have to wait for 3 years. Many commentators suggest it should be just withdrawn immediately. The problem is we can't withdraw it immediately because in its entirety, because then there will be no access to retirement annuity funds until the age of 55 and for pension preservation and provident preservation funds. So we do need to put something in. But the proposal to then, there were other proposals to make it immediate so that the second you become a non-tax resident, you can access those funds. We have not accepted that proposal. We need to look at what this is. I've gone through the rationale for it, but we need to look at the equity between individuals and the tax incentive that we've applied on these funds. So the funds that could be taken after 3 years all have a tax deduction up front. A tax incentive has been applied. The objective of that tax incentive was to save for retirement. Government did not provide a tax incentive for individuals to build up funds to be able to then have enough money to be able to immigrate and cover the costs of immigration. It was for retirement. And there is a very concerning horizontal equity point that we are worried about. If you are a tax resident and you remain within South Africa, you do not leave. There is no other way to access those funds. You can only access those funds when you reach the age of 55. So even by including the 3-year rule, we are creating an inequity between local South Africans who do not leave the country and cannot have access, and other South Africans who do leave the country and can have access after 3 years. Now, we do not believe that this inequity should be worsened by shortening the period. The period, let me go, I think it's in the next part. The period of 3 years is so that an individual cannot move offshore for a very short period of time. It can be up to 184 days where they then become tax resident in another country and have access to those funds and then be able to move back to South Africa. It's a balance that we've had to try and put forward. We believe that 3 years is a relative measure to show that that person has left the country and has left the country for good. By including the proposal, we do recognize that if individuals aren't going to retire in South Africa, that they may be able to take these retirement funds out. But since we no longer have the immigration rule from the Reserve Bank, it's very difficult to tell, you know, when will somebody leave for good and when won't they. The 3 years is a measure to try and assess that, even though individuals may come back after 3 years, which again highlights the inequities between those who can leave and those who cannot. Another comment was that there is uncertainty about whether the requirement to be a non-resident for 3 years refers to the physical presence test or the ordinarily resident test, or if it refers to double tax agreements. And some of the commentators propose that it should only look at ordinarily resident, because ordinarily resident means that that individual has left and has left for good. So if they can prove that they have left for good, they might be able to access those funds within 3 years. This hasn't been accepted. The 3-year rules apply if an individual has ceased to be a tax resident in South Africa, irrespective of the particular test under which that tax residency is determined, either by the ordinarily resident physical presence test or the double tax agreement. SARS does not know, after you have become a non-tax resident, according to one of those 3 measures, they do not follow you and they cannot continue to audit that case to then see whether that person is ordinarily resident or not after that has been broken. Clarity is required with regard to how cases where the immigration process commenced before 1 March 21 but has not been finalized. So there have been quite a few comments on what are the transitional arrangements. What will happen that when this comes in March 2021, what about those people who were under the old exchange control regime? Well, it's still in place. It's not old yet. What will happen if with their applications and whether they will be allowed to access these funds? We've accepted that there should be some leeway and there should be some guidance on this. Our proposal is that if you have made a complete application to the Reserve Bank before 1 March 2021, then you can follow the old rules where that if that process is then approved, even if it is after 1 March 2021, you would still be able to then access your retirement annuity fund, pension preservation fund, or provident preservation fund. So we will keep the current system in place up until 1 March 2021 and all applications that are made before that date, and then they are subsequently approved for immigration from Saab, will be able to access those funds. The new regime will apply for all those who haven't made applications up until that date. We do want to encourage those, to weigh their options, encourage individuals to weigh their options carefully. We've seen quite a few financial advisors push this for our changes to foreign remuneration exemption, which are often done at quite large fees. And we would like them to just look at this issue carefully and perhaps take advice from multiple places, although they would pay more fees in that way, but just to look at it carefully. I think that covers those issues. The next issue, I don't know if you want to do this, Yango, if I should.
You can do it, Chris.
Thanks. The next issue was, which Momo mentioned, was on the is a COVID-related measure which was not included in the budget, which was not included in the initial draft of the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. We don't normally include these types of amendments now, but since this is providing a benefit to taxpayers and because of it's part of the COVID relief measures, we have included it now. We did mention in the response document previously that we would look at these additional tax proposals as long as they don't have an impact on the fiscal framework this year, and we could potentially include them, especially for those that are done on assessment, which is this case. So at the moment, there's a provision, which I mentioned just before, on foreign remuneration, which says that if an individual spends more than 183 days working outside of South Africa, they would qualify for a 1.25 million exemption on the earnings that have related to their time outside of South Africa, as long as those earnings were related to you actually doing this work for that time. However, due to travel bans during COVID, those individuals weren't able to travel outside of South Africa and couldn't qualify and are worried that they cannot qualify for this exemption in this year to no fault of their own. So the comment was, could National Treasury and Government and SARS consider reducing the number of days that employees have to be outside of South Africa to qualify for the exemption of foreign remuneration? The accepted is missing there, but the response is yes, we've accepted that comment and we are going to try and make changes to reduce the impact because of the restrictions on travel. So in order to take into account the lockdown period, it's proposed that we make changes so that the 66 days between 27th of March 2020 and 31 May 2020, when we were under COVID alert levels 5 and 4, should be subtracted from the 183-day threshold. So because of that, the number 183 will be reduced to 117 days. So if an individual is outside of the country for 117 days in any 12-month rolling period for the years of assessment from 29 February 2020 to 28 February 2021, they will be able to claim that exemption. There is another requirement that you need to be outside of the country for a continuous period of at least 60 days. We don't believe we need to change that amendment, as if you are in or out, you wouldn't have been able to move anyway. And if you are going, you can still meet that 60 continuous day period. That's everything from my side. I'll hand back to Younger Olerud. Thank you, Chair.
The next slide is clarifying rollover relief for unbundling transactions. Currently, in the Income Tax Act, we've got corporate reorganization rules that allow for the tax-neutral transfer of assets between companies that form part of the same group of companies. These corporate reorganization rules contain provisions in Section 46 that provide for rollover relief where shares of a resident company, unbundled company, are held by another resident company, unbundling company, are distributed to the shareholders of that unbundling company. As early as 2004, there were restrictions to the application of these rules. These rules were not applying to if you are a non-resident or a pension fund, it was specifically mentioned, and you hold more than 5%, these rules would not apply to you. So therefore, what does that mean is that if the unbundling company is distributing shares and you are a disqualified person, that is, you are a non-resident or a retirement fund, the rules would not apply to you if you hold more than 5%. The rationale for excluding people that are not subject to tax is that the rules are meant to be a deferral, not an exemption. Because when you are at a deferral, it's a temporary concession with a view to collect tax later. In 2007, changes were made to the rules whereby the percentage increase was increased, the percentage shareholding was increased from 5% to 20%. However, there were no changes made as to the specific list of disqualified persons. Similarly, even though the percentage shareholding was increased, but the rules would not apply to people that are not subject to tax in South Africa, meaning that the non-residents as well as the pension funds, because they are exempt. Come 2020, we noticed some schemes whereby there were anti-avoidance schemes that were trying to circumvent these rules. And in the budget, the next slide, we made proposal, the next slide, Chris. In order to close this loophole, in the budget, there was a proposal to remove the reference to the connected person test. And then on the draft bill that was published for public comment on 31 July 2020, we put the proposal as it was in the budget, whereby we removed the reference to the connected person test. And these proposals, because it was an anti-avoidance measure, were deemed to have come into effect on the date of the publication of the draft bill, that is 31 July 2020. So those were the effective date of the proposal. We received comments from taxpayers and we had public consultation. The first public consultation on the draft TLAB, whereby we discussed this provision, was on the 10th of September 2020. In the public workshop. Further to those public workshop meetings, we had another separate consultative meeting with those taxpayers that submitted comments specifically on this issue. That is the normal practice that we do, whereby we can have a public workshop and then we have to discuss issues further. So we discuss issues further again on the meeting on the 23rd of September 2020. Again on the 7th of October 2020, during the public hearings, there were comments on this issue. I think the main issue that was said was that the proposed rule in the 2020 draft TLAB is too punitive. That was the main issue. Because they were saying that by removing the reference to the connected person test, it makes it an all or nothing rule. Those were the main issues that were raised. As a result, during the discussions, both on the 10th of September and the 23rd of September, the taxpayers because we are discussing what is the rule that can have less impact than what you are saying. There was a view during the meetings to say maybe the rule before 2007, whereby there was no connected person test, but there was a 5% shareholding, we should revert back to that rule. However, there were issues regarding that rule, as you have seen from the submission, I think from Bowman and Gilflin last week, whereby they wanted to know if there is a de minimis, how much is the percentage, and secondly, how will the pro rata be applied? I will hand over to Lerato to explain the mechanics of the revised proposal. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Yanga. Good day, Honorable Chair and members. So in arriving at a rule now that replaces the all or nothing rule that was in the draft bill, we then are moving on to a pro rata rule, which will operate in a way that ensures that there is rollover relief where the all or nothing rule said if you exceed the 20% threshold, there will be no unbundling transaction at all. So under the pro rata rule, unbundling transactions in the context, particularly in the listed space, will be allowed, but the rollover, basically the deferral, so basically the benefit of not paying tax immediately, will only be allowed for the unbundling company, which is the company that's distributing shares it holds in another entity to its shareholders, to the extent that those shares that it distributes to its shareholders are distributed to persons that are not included in the disqualified persons list. So basically the list that Yanga alluded to, that basically has a list of people in respect of which are exempt or outside of the tax net because of their residency. That being said, because of the way the listed space is and for tracking purposes, there is a de minimis to the pro rata rule of 5%. That means that you will have your rollover and the benefit will be limited to those shares that are distributed to persons that are not disqualified persons. But in the instance that it's distributed to a disqualified person, that rollover will be allowed to the extent that that disqualified person does not hold more than 5% of the shares in the distributing company. I think that's where I'm going to end it, Yanga. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Are you done with the responses?
No, Chair, not yet. Yanga?
Okay.
No, okay. Income tax, business tax incentives. Next slide. In the current Tax Act contains rules in Section 36 and Section 15, whereby we make provision for tax treatment of allowable mining capital expenditure. The rules make provision for carrying on mining operation as defined to get a full upfront deduction of any capital expenditure in respect of mining operation. The difference between mining companies and other maybe manufacturing companies is that when you are carrying on mining operation, you get that full capital expenditure in year one. However, when you are carrying on other different operation businesses, you get that capital expenditure over a period of 5 years, 4 or 5 years, depending. But it has never been an upfront deduction in year one. So this implies that any company that is carrying on mining operations in South Africa has got a benefit of full upfront deduction. So this is a timing benefit, rather. Now, the current provisions of the tax legislation do not adequately address the tax treatment of capital expenditure incurred by taxpayers carrying on activities of contract mining. We have seen that the business models of mining companies are changing, and mining companies are not doing their business themselves. Maybe those mining companies that have been given the mining right by MP, in terms of the MPRDA, they get the services of contract mining. An issue is whether both a contract miner that excavates minerals on behalf of the mineral rights holder for a fee should qualify for full upfront deduction of any capital expenditure in respect of mining operation. As a result, we propose changes in the draft TLEP that was published for comment to say that the person or the business that can be that can only qualify for full upfront deduction in respect of mining operation is only that taxpayer that holds a mineral right as defined in Section 1 of the MPRDA. So if you do not have a mineral right, you do not qualify. But it's not like you do not qualify at all. It's not that you're not going to get your full capital deduction in year one. Your capital deduction will be spread over a period of 4 or 5 years, depending on type of on the type of business you are doing. We received a number of comments from the industry to say that we should withdraw this provision. Chair, I think you remember last week, there were a lot of people that were talking about this. I like the side one because they accepted that in principle, contract mining should be distinguished from whole-scale mining in that contract mining should not qualify for the same tax treatment of allowable mining capital expenditure, especially the timing of the claim for capital expenditure contemplated in Section 36, whereby you get immediate 100% deduction in year one. However, they understood the problems regarding the implementation of this proposal now, and they requested that we postpone the implementation and there should be more discussion between Mining Resource Council and the Department of Mineral Resources. The next slide. The issue also with the proposal was the issue of joint ventures. We were told that in the mining industry, joint ventures are allowed also by the Department of Mineral Resources. So if we implement this proposal to say only the person who has got a mining right in terms of MPRDA can qualify, meaning that it will kill the business model of joint ventures. And then lastly, we were told that this proposal has far-reaching consequences in the industry, in the mining tax, in the industry, mining industry. As a result, they requested that we do a study and we consider maybe the DTC recommendations, because DTC, Davis Tax Committee, made recommendations in terms of the mining tax regime in South Africa. They are of the view that we have to look at this fully. We do a full review before we can implement piecemeal changes. As such, next slide. We are proposing that we are happy that at least the industry understands that the full upfront deduction is not supposed to be. Contract miners should not qualify for the full upfront deduction because they do not incur all the expenditure that is incurred by maybe those that are doing whole-scale mining. More especially, we were told in the workshops that contract mining is big business, more especially in the open cast coast. Based on that, we said we must understand the industry before we can implement the provisions. As a result, we're going to withdraw this provision in the 2020 draft TLEP. It's going to be withdrawn completely, this proposal, and government will investigate and find solutions that may have less negative impact, and then we're going to do a review. It is important to note that the review is going to be done piecemeal. Once we've done with one part, it may be ready for implementation. So it's not like we're going to say, wait for the whole review. Hence, you are saying that
we must be given more time to investigate and find solutions that may have less negative impact on the mining industry. Next slide. Changing the Minister of Finance discretion in lifting ring fencing of capital expenditure per mine. I remember, Chair, there was a lady from Vendata whereby who wanted to make comments last week, and you promised her that when we respond, we're going to respond even on the written comments. Hence, we have included this slide to keep the promise that you have made to the lady last week. Currently, Section 367F of the Income Tax Act makes provision for the tax-deductible capital expenditure incurred in relation to a mine not to be used to reduce taxable income of another mine, unless the Minister of Finance, in consultation with the Minister of Minerals, Resources and Energy, and having regard to the relevant fiscal and financial technical implication, otherwise directs. This limitation is called CAPEX per mine ring fence. This provision was introduced some time ago. However, over a period of about 10 years, we have only received two applications. As a result, in the draft legislation that was published for public comment, a proposal was made to remove this discretion from the Minister of Finance and put this discretion under the Commissioner for SARS, and also put a specific criteria for lifting the CAPEX per mine ring fence. Next slide. We received a lot of comments against this proposal because the comments were like, if we put this proposal under Commissioner for SARS, Commissioner for SARS is a tax administrator, whereas the Minister of Finance is the policymaker. So it is best suited if the discretion remains with the Minister of Finance. Next slide. Another thing that they said is that to the extent that the request to withdraw this proposed amendment is not accepted, they propose that the criteria that we put should be more objective. So I think an issue was that the current criteria has got necessary fiscal, financial, and technical insight. So their view is that SARS is not equipped to do or to make discretion based on that criteria, because SARS is a tax administrator, and yet that criteria can be best suited with the Minister of Finance. As a result, we are proposing that we withdraw this proposal altogether, and when we do the mining review that we referred to in the previous slides, we also look at this provision. And then the provision can only be implemented once the review of the mining tax regime has been done. Thank you, Chair. That's all from my side. I think now back to Chris on carbon tax.
Thank you, Chair. Mimi, are you here?
Yes, Chris. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yes, perfect. Thanks, Mimi.
Okay. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to address the issues that were raised with on the carbon tax passed through for the oil refineries. So in the carbon tax policy paper of 2013, we made a case that since the market is faces regulated prices, we would allow the industry a certain amount of pass-through, but it can't be 100% of the cost of the carbon tax, because we want the industry to take into account the negative externalities and to do something about their emissions. So we've consulted with industry since 2018, and we also have made consultations with the Department of Minerals, Mineral Resources and Energy before we finalized our proposal. So we had proposed to have a limited pass-through for the oil refineries, and the comments that we received on that proposal included the fact that they wanted us to backdate that pass-through to the 1st of June 2019 when the carbon tax was implemented. And we have agreed, because in the proposal we had said it will only commence in 2021. But after that comment, we've made changes, and we will allow the effective date of the pass-through to be from the 1st of January 2020. We unfortunately cannot do it to the 1st of June 2019 because the industry is currently filing their taxes for the 2019 period and retroactive application, because by the time this is finalized, it will be probably the end of 2020. So we won't be able to do the retroactive application of the pass-through. And then the other comment was the amount of the pass-through. They asked for a provision for us to adjust it for inflation, and this has been accepted, and we will include it in the current draft TLAB, and the amount of the adjustment would try to match what's in the Carbon Tax Act in terms of how the carbon tax changes for the first phase, which is CPI plus 2 percentage points. Next slide. I indicated the reason why we said we're going to have some form of pass-through was because the industry faces a regulated market. So in our proposal, though, we are only going to allow the pass-through for petrol for the petrol production. And the reason and the comment from them was they have the liquefied petroleum gas, illuminating paraffin and diesel, are also regulated in terms of their prices. So we consulted with the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, and the justification for us, so the comment for us to include all those other products in this pass-through mechanism is not accepted. And the reason being, when you consulted with the Department of Minerals and Energy, in the first place, for illuminating paraffin, we don't impose a carbon tax, especially the one that's used for domestic uses. So it's not in the carbon tax net. And it has a single maximum retail price, which is what they say is regulated. But because it's not in the carbon tax net, we will not consider it. And then for the LPG, our understanding from the department is that the regulated maximum retail price that we announce, government announces every month, is actually set for retailers who sell LPG to domestic consumers up to 9 kgs. So the retail prices for household consumers are the ones that are set at the maximum retail price. But what happens in the commercial sector is not covered by that single maximum retail price. So for that reason, we're not going to consider it. And then the diesel prices are regulated at the wholesale level. And according to the department, that wholesale price that we announce every month is actually a reference price, which means the industry has a lever to maneuver the price that actually is charged to the final consumer. So since they have that lever in terms of the diesel prices, we're not going to consider it for the pass-through because they could use that lever to recover the carbon tax costs. So we'll only allow the pass-through for the petrol production because it is the only product that has its price regulated up to the retail level. So they don't really have much lever to include the cost in their pricing. Next slide. So the initial proposal was we're going to have a 0.1 cents per liter pass-through. And the comment came that when you compare that amount to the carbon fuel levy that we impose on petrol and diesel, it is very low and we should actually increase that amount. And the fact that the industry was comparing itself to the electricity generators. And our response to that is we partially accept, but we just want to emphasize that the rationale for the pass-through that we are talking about for the refineries does not have a bearing on the carbon fuel levy, because this pass-through is for emissions that happen at the refinery level, whereas the carbon fuel levy is what we impose for the emissions that come from your use of the petrol and the diesel, because it also results in emissions. So we have different, because of the points where emissions happen, we have different levels of where we're applying this carbon tax. And I guess that's for industry not to confuse the fact that because through the fuel administration mechanism, we impose the carbon fuel levy at the refinery gate, because that's where administratively it is easy for government to impose. That has no bearing to the emissions that you produce when you're producing the final product. And also the incidence of the 7 and 6 cents lies on the consumers, although we collect it at the refinery gate level. So, and also to note that we never committed to a fuel price neutrality for the refineries, unlike what we did for the electricity sector. So there should be, there shouldn't be that comparison. But in light of the latest data that we got from industry, we've decided, we're proposing to increase that amount of the pass-through to 50% of the pass-through cost for petrol. And this is based on us looking at the current emissions that happen at the refinery level, and looking at what the attributable emissions based on their production of petrol. And that gives us a 100% pass-through rate of 1 cent per liter. But we are going to allow a 50% cost pass-through. So we're proposing to give them a 0.56 cents per liter as a pass-through for petrol production. I think, yes, that is all. Thank you.
Thanks, Mimi. Thanks, Chair. Yanga Mama, I don't know if you want to say anything before we move on to the TALAB.
No, I'm fine, Chris.
Okay, probably Franz can go. Thanks, Chair.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. So we move on to the administrative side of things, and we start off with the ability to raise an assessment based on an estimate. This slide just essentially recaps on what the current situation is and what the proposal was, which was essentially to allow SARS to raise an estimate where somebody did not provide information requested and then not be able to object until such time as the information was provided, and also to make some changes to assist in the modernization of the tax assessment system so that we could do things like auto-assessment. So moving on to the next slide. So here the comment was that it's problematic that we expect there be a response to the request for information, or that the information be provided, because there may sometimes be situations where there is in fact a legitimate dispute about whether the taxpayer should be providing that information. And so the issue here then is, how do we resolve that? And what we're suggesting we do here is say, okay, so we're not going to be expecting that you provide us the information. We expect you to provide us with a response to the query. And so if there is a legitimate reason why you don't provide the information itself, but you do provide us with a response, at least we're engaging and we can then move forward. So that is the proposal then. We will change the proposed legislation so it's not the actual information that needs to be supplied, but that it is a response. Now, I should immediately caution that obviously what someone may now think they can do is just send us a one-page meaningless response, and I don't think that would be adequate, but it's something that we would need to monitor, and if this becomes an issue in the future, we may have to revisit this particular concession. Moving to the next slide. Now, here the issue is, well, sometimes taxpayers are not aware of the request for information. So we need to do something about that. And we're just highlighting here that there are, in fact, mechanisms available on e-filing so that you can be notified of the fact that a request has been put through. Again, even if you do miss this, all that needs to happen is that you respond to the request once it's brought to your attention. And then if SARS does not take account of that response when you have given it, you may then object and appeal in the ordinary course. Moving on. Now, here there is an ancillary point, which is that theoretically and in practice sometimes, we can ask you for information in respect of third parties. And that is correct. But the point that is made is, well, then if I don't provide that information, why should you be able to raise an estimate and not be able to object to it? Now, it does puzzle us a little bit as to on what basis SARS would raise an estimate if you are not providing information in respect of a third party, because an estimate would be raised when that is information pertaining to your affairs. But to avoid any doubt here, the proposal is that we will accept this and make an adjustment to the legislation to make that clear. Here we have a proposal to allow SARS some time to find out if an unallocated payment is something that was meant to be for some other debt that the taxpayer has for with SARS, or is in fact something that needs to be refunded. The difficulty here is that it can actually be quite difficult and challenging to find where a payment belongs. Sometimes it's obvious. Someone pays you 102,000 rand on one particular account, but you can see there's a debt of 102,000 rand sitting somewhere else. So there's a reasonable probability that they meant to pay that and not this. Now, if SARS were to simply make the 102,000 rand refund, you would end up potentially with a penalty and interest on the other debt that would remain outstanding. So it's in fact in both the taxpayer and SARS' interest to try and get these matching and reconciliation processes done. Now, a taxpayer can avoid the problem by using the correct references and so on, but that doesn't always happen, and so hence this proposal to allow SARS some time. The pushback here is that the 60 business days, essentially 3 months that was being proposed, is too long, and on reflection, we agree. We will shorten that to 1 month, and if SARS then does not make the refund within that period, interest will run and until such time as SARS does make the refund. Moving on. Now, currently, if SARS is in the progress of an audit, for example, and a refund is due on the particular return or assessment that the refund arises from, SARS has the discretion not to make the refund. Obviously, that may be because there's some risks that have been identified, which is why we're doing the audit in the first place, and we need to be satisfied that risk doesn't exist before the refund is made. Now, there's a bit of an obvious gap here in that that discretion does not exist for criminal investigations, where the risk is potentially even larger. So the proposal was to extend the discretion not to make the refund to also cover criminal. Now, the proposition that's been made here is this is a breach of rights because we're breaching the presumption of innocence. And no, that is not the case at all. We're simply retaining the refund to manage the risk. There is an existing mechanism where if the taxpayer provides security, SARS must make the refund. In other words, that overrides the discretion. Unfortunately, there was a bit of an oversight here. We didn't extend that discretion to also cover this. So the proposal here is that we will extend the provision so that if the taxpayer that is under criminal investigation provides security, the refund can be made. And we now move on to probably the most contentious item in the bill, which is around the removal of the requirement to prove intent or willfulness for certain so-called lesser tax offences. Now, as the brief summary of the rest, the background to this suggests, this is something that was in the legislation before. It is, in fact, quite difficult to prove intent when someone didn't do something. I mean, people will obviously and frequently know why they had something for breakfast. But if I asked you, why didn't you have something else for breakfast, it becomes a lot more difficult. And although that's a simplistic example, it gives you a sense of some of the difficulties you encounter when you have to prove intent when it relates to something that hasn't been done. So moving on to the next slide, the proposal then was to drop willfully and simply retain without just cause. And as committee members will remember, there was a good deal of opposition here. The first ground of opposition is that this is something that the Constitutional Court has found against. And several judgments were quoted on, and one particular one of interest is the one that is here, which is the case of State versus Kutsia and others. And the text that supports the idea that intent is the key component is then on this slide. But if you move to the next slide, you will see that the court went a little further. The court looked at a good deal of comparative law around what is known as absolute and strict liability and defenses available to that, and then came to the point that said, if you look at the comparative law, punishment is appropriate if an unlawful act is intentionally or negligently, and I think that's the important point here, or negligently conducted. So that's the first point there. The other is that the court also pointed out that Parliament should be allowed significant leeway. In other words, there's a good deal of deference that is likely to be placed on Parliament's decision on whether something is negligent or intent is required, and it is only if it is sort of grossly disproportionate that the Constitutional Court would step in. And the wording here is, of course, manifestly inappropriate. So it has to be really clearly inappropriate. So the long and the short of this aspect of the presentation then is to simply emphasize that the Constitutional Court has recognized the role that negligence can play in criminal offenses. Moving on to the next slide. So the next point that's raised is that, well, we'll see a floodgate of these kinds of floods. The floodgates will be open. There'll be a flood of these kinds of prosecutions if we go down this road. And as was mentioned to members when the initial presentation was made, and as is reinforced here, that is a rather surprising assertion to make, because that's how the law read up until 2011. And this didn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because negligence has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt by the prosecution. And so the prosecution looks very carefully at these kinds of cases. Moving on to the next slide. Now, here we have a comment that points out that strict liability is not something that we should be going for. And that is correct. The Constitutional Court, I think, has made it clear that strict liability is something that we would not be going for. And just to remind members, strict liability is where the prosecution doesn't have to prove either intent or negligence. It may involve some kind of defense afterwards by the accused, and that's the approach some countries follow. But that is not what we're proposing here. And so this particular comment is accepted, and we will make it clear that we're not seeking to go with strict liability, but negligence. Okay. Now the proposition is made that the use of negligence is restricted to truly serious crimes. Now, I would initially point out that tax is the foundation of the ability of the state to function. And so tax is clearly something that is important. Now, I'm not trying to make the case that it is important as death, or although there is the old aphorism that nothing is as certain as death and taxes. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at the legal textbooks or the case law, you'll see there are a vast variety of acts that have either explicitly or been interpreted by the courts to require the standard of negligence, and certainly not in the cases of the level that are supposed here by the commentator. So the proposition that we're making here is that it's certainly not limited to death, you know, negligence that gives rise to death as a result of the faulty product. That is not the case. I'm moving on to the next slide. The proposition in this particular slide is that it's actually quite easy for the prosecution to prove intent, a specific type of intent, given the kinds of inferences that a court must draw. In essence, the response here is that in practice, that is not the case. The court may draw inferences. And again, we come to the point that it has to be beyond reasonable doubt. If anyone who's followed the media over the past few years, where some of the cases revolving around dolus eventualis have been decided, will be aware of just how contested the terrain that is and how difficult it is, in fact, for the prosecution to make that case. Moving on. So the point here that is made is that we do not have the different concepts of negligence in South Africa, and the issue to respond to here is that that is correct. Those are generally cases where we are looking at aspects of strict liability often, and then the questions of what kind of defense is available, of due diligence. And again, in South Africa, the model is quite different in that it is for the prosecution to prove negligence beyond reasonable doubt. So the burden starts with the prosecution, and so it is the prosecution that has got to jump that very high hurdle of beyond reasonable doubt. To the extent that there are issues around proportionality, we emphasize that all the legislation does is set maximum penalties. So the presiding officer, the magistrate or judge, is in a situation to look at just how culpable the accused is and set a punishment anything from a fine of 500 rand or up to a term of imprisonment, depending on the nature of the offense, how culpable the person was. So if we're dealing with a situation where you just cross the threshold of negligence, it may well be that the punishment that is imposed is nominal, whereas if you have significantly exceeded that threshold and the matter is a really serious one involving large sums of money or third-party funds, that then the presiding officer would move up the scale to a more significant punishment. Moving on to the next slide. The proposition here is that although this may be appropriate for some of the offences, it's not appropriate for others, and some of these, the classic one that is cited here is, what's the problem if we don't change our address? Now, if you have a look at the Tax Administration Act, if we don't have your address and we send notices, we take action, SARS must, in fact, withdraw those notices if you can show that you didn't receive the notice. And the only exclusion there is for an assessment. So now you can see the problem. If you don't give us your address, we can't send you notices. And if we do send it to the wrong address, you can say, you rightfully say that you didn't get them. And so large portions of the Tax Administration Act then sort of run into significant difficulties in following through to their natural conclusion. So what seems like a relatively innocuous issue can actually translate into quite a serious issue in some circumstances. So we would respectfully submit that there are reasons for the various offences that have been set out. And the response document looks at some of the examples that have been given. Moving on. Now, the comment here is, well, you've got administrative penalties and they should solve your problem. So why don't you just have more administrative penalties and resolve it on that basis? And regrettably, as experience has shown, although administrative penalties do assist, there are cases where they seem not to have an impact. And so an additional level of compliance tool is available, is necessary in order to address these issues. I should also add that one of the issues taxpayers should be aware of on a switch to administrative penalties is that administrative penalties are normally decided on a balance of probabilities, whereas a criminal offence is, as I've stated already, beyond reasonable doubt. The standards are quite different, and it's in fact easier to impose an administrative penalty. The next proposition is that by extending the number of offences, we are creating difficulties for people emigrating and filling certain positions. Two points to be made here. The first is, again, as we've noted, this was the case in years past, and these difficulties did not seem to arise in practice. But more fundamentally, it is for the other custodians of legislation, countries and employers to decide what they regard as problematic. And so it is their discretion and their decisions that are the issue here, not what we are doing. I'm moving on. We are then criticized for looking at international precedent. And the point is made that in one particular precedent we're looking at, the Australian judges have criticized Parliament. We make the point here that it's striking that countries like Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, which have strong tax compliance cultures, in fact, take it a step further than we do and go to strict or absolute liability with some defences. So they clearly regard it as serious. And as you can see, we don't have those kinds of level of compliance. And we provide more details about that particular Australian judgment in the response document, where you will see that, in fact, the judgment and what Parliament decided coincided. The next comment is that SARS decides who to prosecute and extending the number of offences, which, by the way, would increase the ambit of SARS's discretion here. We make the obvious point in response that it's not SARS that decides who to prosecute. It is for the National Prosecuting Authority. We do concede that SARS has to prioritize its criminal investigations, and clearly it does that to seek to achieve the highest compliance impact. Moving on to the next slide. position here is that we should have a balanced approach, and we certainly accept that. If you look at our strategic plan, you will see that it specifically looks to a balanced approach through three of its first three strategic objectives, and there is, in fact, a balance of proactive and reactive measures that are being implemented. The issue here is whether the reactive measures are fully effective. Our suggestion at this point is that they are not fully effective and that they need some beefing up in order to ensure that taxpayers that do not comply are brought to book. Moving on. And this is my last slide, and I end on a positive note here, which is that the proposition is made that we should either withdraw, and we don't believe that is appropriate, or that we should adopt a differentiated approach. And on analysis, we agree that that is, in fact, appropriate. Not that we withdraw, but that we adopt a differentiated approach. So the provisions will be redrafted to separate the offences that currently live in the three affected sections into two categories. The one category will relate to duties that must be performed. And here the standard will be willfulness or negligence. And there will be a second category that will deal with those which that effectively imply a certain degree of intent. And this would be the provision of incomplete or false documents, dissipation of assets, and so on. And that would then require the higher standard of intent. And in as far as proportionality is concerned, again, we would maintain the existing maxima in respect of the punishment that may be imposed and permit the presiding officer in any particular case to decide on the basis of all the facts, being the degree of culpability, the nature of the offence, the seriousness of the offence, and so on, to decide what the appropriate punishment would be, which, as I've mentioned, could either be quite modest or quite significant, just depending on how those factors come out. And that is it from my side. Thank you.
Chair, I think that's it from our side. So, Yanga, Chris, do you have anything? I think we have. Okay. Yanga, are you okay? Everyone?
Yes, Momo, we are done. Thank you very much.
Okay, Chair, over to you. Be ready for questions.
Okay, Treasury and SARS for the detailed response. Honorable members, that's the response from Treasury and SARS in regard to TILAB, TALAB, and the rates bill. It is your time now to engage with the responses. Alan, you assist me and Sister Teboho in identifying members who would like to make comments and ask clarity seeking questions. I don't see anybody on the screen from my side. Alan and Teboho from your side, can you see somebody?
For now, on the chat, Chairperson, is only Jordan Hill Lewis that would like to ask a question?
Okay. Honorable Lewis, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have this presentation from National Treasury. Let me first say I really do genuinely appreciate the very comprehensive nature of the replies. I've been looking at my own notes and going back to look at the comments. It seems that every proposal has been quite comprehensively replied to, and you know, even though some obviously have not been agreed to, they've all been thoroughly worked through. I also really appreciate that the issue that I have raised, which wasn't in the bills, but which I've raised several times around the expat workers, has been replied to, and that Treasury has made an allowance or a plan to accommodate those expat workers in the way that they have proposed. I'm very grateful for that. And it's good to see that we can still get new issues through the system and get the ear of the Treasury to listen and respond appropriately to these things. So once again, thank you for that work. I've got three brief questions. I heard what Chris said, or Mr. Axelson said, on the metals export tax. And I suppose I must say I'm pleased that it will move to an ad valorem tax. I personally am not a fan of the tax at all. And for many of the same reasons, actually, that Mr. Axelson expressed. And I think I can read between the lines there. But can you just tell us what the ad valorem rate is going to be? Because that's not in your slide. And I don't think that you mentioned it verbally. That's quite important. Then on the issue of the bursaries, Chairperson, you'll recall that some time ago, I think it was maybe the very first time that we discussed this bill, probably middle of September, I think, that you asked the National Treasury to check who the most important beneficiaries of the bursary scheme are, and to check whether it would be the kind of emerging black middle class working class workers, employees. And I haven't seen the Treasury come back with some more research on that question. And I would still like to see it. And also, there was a request to investigate exactly how much it cost the fiscus. Because, you know, if you can point to very significant benefits and the cost is very tiny, you know, then there's more of an argument to be made that this benefit should be retained in its entirety. I understand that you have kind of met us halfway with the proposals that you've made today, but I do still think it would be useful for the committee to receive that information that you did ask for, Chairman. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are you done, Honorable Louis?
Yes, sir, I'm done.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Honorable Skosani, over to you.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Greetings to Honorable Members and to the officials from Treasury. Yeah, on the TLAB, in relation to the issue of the bursaries, the employee salary sacrifice bursary, I see that the department is acceding to the requests that were made by various structures last week, that they should maintain this bursary in its form, wherein employees are going to sacrifice part of their salary, and that it should therefore be limited to the relatives of those particular employees. So what I want to know is, to what extent are the institutions that administer this bursary regulated or monitored? Because it looks like it is not the employer per se that administers those funds. The employer is just a conveyor belt. He would just deduct money from the employee and take it to another institution that will be responsible for administering that money. So I want to know, to what extent are those institutions monitored and regulated, just to make sure that those employees, they get value for money. You don't put a lot of money, but you get little. But find that those institutions, they are investing those funds, they are making a lot of money, but then the employees, they only get a small portion of those contributions. So to what extent are they monitoring or regulating such institutions? Thanks, Chair.
Alan, are there other members who want to make contributions from your side?
No, Chair, there's nothing on the chat and there's no hands either.
Okay. Over to Treasury and SARS in regard to those clarity-seeking questions from Honorable Lewis and Honorable Skosa.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, do you want to start off with Yanga or France?
Thanks. I can start with the question on the export tax. We didn't include the table in the presentation, but if members did receive the response document, it should be on page, on page 17. I don't think I can share my screen. I'll see if I can. No, I can't share my screen at the moment, but there's a table on page 17. We've created a new category for stainless steel, which I mentioned, which is at 15%. Ferrous metals at 20%, aluminium at 15%, red metals at 10%, and other at 20%. These are in line with the percentages that were provided in the initial consultation on the export duty on scrap metal that was put forward by ITAC. And they correlate to the same fixed rate amounts. It's an equivalent duty in that initial consultation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to the bursaries, Honorable Kosana, we are not reinstating the element of salary sacrifice. The element of salary sacrifice is the one we are saying that if the employer is providing bursaries and then there is an element of salary sacrifice, then the bursary will not qualify for exemption in this regard. So we are not reinstating that element of salary sacrifice. What we are saying is that if you provide to members of general public, and if you do provide to, it should be provided to the relatives and not the employees, are not included in this category of the amendment. I remember the chair, what happened is that according to the income threshold, this provision apply to those employees who are earning 600,000 because we increased the income thresholds in 2016. So what we are saying is that you cannot say it is a bursary if it is an, if it has an element of a salary sacrifice. You cannot say that this is a bursary because this is not a bona fide bursary. You are taking money pre-tax to pay for the school fees. With regard to the actual cost, I was looking at the emails because I remember Chris sending this email. I think we can provide on the return response document because there is that email regarding the cost because I think it's costed on the tax expenditure side. Thank you, Chair.
France, anything from your side? I think we've answered everything.
Nothing from my side. There was the question about who benefits from this, and I don't believe we have those statistics because this would be done by the employers, and they would know who benefits, but that is not information that would be passed on.
So, Chair, we are done.
I mean, maybe just in terms of the regulation.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, just in terms of the regulation, you know, this is only for NQF-qualified institutions. So the regulation is in relation to the training and education part, and there are strict controls there, and then those can be correlated. I'm not too sure about the regulation of the institution itself, because I don't think it actually, Oma, you might know, but I don't think it falls under FSEA.
Okay. Now, Chair, we are done in answering the two questions.
Okay. Alan, are there other members who would like to make comments or ask questions?
Chair, I see Mrs. Kasana raises his hand again.
Mkloni Jos Kasana, follow-up question?
Yeah, no. No, Nyatoko was a good woman, but... No, my apology. I think I misunderstood the earlier presentation on the issue of salary sacrifice. Now, based on this response by Mrs. Young, if she says if there's an element of salary sacrifice, it's not exempted, and then because it's not a bona fide bazaar, then the question is it allowed to be done by the employers? Is it allowed to be done? Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Kosana, employers can do it, but employees will be subject to tax. So they're not going to qualify for bursary in terms of Section 101Q. However, they are going to be subject to tax because we cannot say employers and employees cannot restructure their salary. Anyone is allowed to restructure the salary, but when you restructure your salary, there are tax impacts. So if it's done like that, there's going to be tax, and then there can be fringe benefit tax. So that's what we are saying, that there's no exemption, but the taxes will apply as contemplated in the Income Tax Act. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Any hands, Alan, from your side? I can't see a hand here on my screen.
From members, no, Chair, but there is a hand from one of the stakeholders, Francois Liebenberg. I'm not sure if you're going to open it for that purpose.
No. Francois, the agenda is in such a way that, or the process, it's in such a way that you had a bite when a national treasurer was doing consultations, and then you came to Parliament last week, made the oral presentation, oral and written presentation. So today is another leg in regard to the process, whereby Treasury and SARS responds. And then the committee asks questions and make comments. What is going to happen in terms of the next process? Okay. In terms of the next process, the bills will be tabled with the MTBPS, which will include any amendment. The committee will then deliberate on the report on the 4th of November, and then vote on the bills. For now, it's the 4th of November, which is a date set aside for the committee deliberations. From there, the process goes to the NCOP. So I hope our stakeholders understand how the process unfolds from the time when Treasury initiates with the SARS to when they make inputs to be where we are and the next step. So that's it. Are we done with members asking questions and making comments?
Yes, Chair, there's no more hands and there's nothing on the chat line either.
Okay. As I was clarifying that the bills will be tabled with the MTBBS and we'll then deliberate on the 4th of November. By the way, the MTBBS, Alan, is it on the 20th? When is it?
Chair, next Wednesday. The date next Wednesday is the 21st.
Okay. Yeah, so the MTBBS will be tabled next week Wednesday, and then we'll take the process from there. Thanks very much, honorable members, officials from Treasury, SARS, officials from Parliament, our stakeholders. But it doesn't mean that stakeholders, their doors closed to keep on engaging with the National Treasury. They've got the right to do so, because we live in a democratic state. If ever you have got other issues that you want to make a follow-up, feel free even to write to us. We'll respond to those issues. So the door is not closed for the public to keep on engaging government, department and entities, including Parliament. So I wanted to clarify that, colleagues. The meeting is adjourned. We'll meet tomorrow when we deal with... what act is it, Alan, that we are dealing with tomorrow? Is the auditing profession?
Yes, Chair. It's the auditing profession amendment bill. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's bill 2.
Okay. So, colleagues, we'll meet tomorrow when we deal with the amendment bill. Thanks very much. Yeah, Comrade Momo, you see, now you look decent. The T-shirt,
yes.
It was unlike you. He's a veteran of administration.
No apologies, Chair.
Okay. I understand. Okay. You might not have slept working on these responses.
Anyway, thank you, Chair.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, Chris.
Thank you, Chair Babash. Thank you, members.
You are resisting. You want to stay in the second revolution. Belongs to our grandparents. We want to see you in the first industrial.